Good evening. I'm sitting quite alone, not necessarily lonely, but alone in the main celebration space of Pebble Hill's Red Barn. And I think one or two Night Sky Sangha inmates will be showing up. Just for fun, we can throw a few ideas around. There's so many you know, fun observations one can make of or from the presentation of consciousness, of phenomena, of self-experience. You sure don't need to create a religion. To institutionalize the generous nature of conscious contact, the proliferative nature of mental association, the imagination of oneself drawn arbitrarily from the streaming nature of first-hand experience. You know, for fun, to get technical. Hi. What you could call, you know, naked or primary experience is not splintered. It's not objectified. So even in the midst of the volume and the pressure of felt experience, you could say there is still a luminous quality of silence. It's not the absence of sound, but the absence of objectification, the absence of accusation or assignment, or the reflex to figure things out or to place oneself in the equation of present being. Human suffering in the myriad ways that it shows up, demonstrates, attracts our attention. Psychological suffering, for sure, is downstream of the reflex, the involuntary reflex, perhaps the conditioned reflex, to objectify and therefore splinter the streaming nature of present experience. What we refer to as the I or me, mine or ego or sense of separative or individuated being is an artifact, is a symptom of the reflex to objectify, to name, to compare, to value. And the reflex to name and to compare and to value is what suggests psychological time, or the coordinates of location. And therefore all of the, you know, pride and vulnerabilities that accompany the persona of at least the human being. If our spiritual energy is focused on amelioration, justification, supplication, sequestration, then we remain in the loop of objectifying experience, making it all about me, and the fundamental existential insecurity that accompanies individuation. Of course, there are so many interesting, if not fascinating, and exotic remedies for the myriad and intoxicating nature of human suffering that, of course, we could spend a lifetime, if not lifetimes, trying on every new hat and piece of clothing, used or new, to attempt to ameliorate our discomfort, our grief, our insecurity. But if we're merely playing with the artifacts of an imaginary self, then no meaningful healing or lapse can occur. Because we remain under the influence of the myth of space, time, and person, circumstances, events, and the stress of becoming. So the whatever the spiritual journey might be. Thankfully, nobody knows. Maybe a reveal begins to occur through whatever circumstances it occurs, that the quality of attention, present attention, shifts from objectification, the naming of objects and the creating of distraction, creating of distance. That reflex begins to settle down, not be so demanding. One can begin to sense the impersonal, non-objective, reference-free nature of present experience. So in that regard, you can say that healing, to use that word, isn't a movement of behavior or a movement of gratitude, compassion, bodhicitta, or goodwill, though those, of course, are nice to have. But the healing is actually the obliteration in a non-remarkable moment of the myth of self, of the prideful continuity of context and content. One might be gifted to sense the unfracturable nature of presence, which is the intimacy of being the collapse of craving, placing oneself in a context, or suffering the unsatisfactoriness of conditions. And this quality of mindfulness is not a practice or a repetition. There's no movement or motive to recall anything, to strategize, to predict future behavior, to justify or forgive. this quality of mindfulness is not self-referencing. The troublesome nature of personal history, including regrets, resentments, and injuries, dominant. Its nature is ahimsa, or non-harming, but not by vow. The release of the stress of individuation is non-harming. We think we need to process suffering and the end of suffering through means, equations, strategies, causality, repetitive commitment or application through one or a thousand forms of yoga or purification. But these are just the adornments, ornaments of emptiness itself. So there's no real compelling need to process what has or hasn't happened in the imagination, the arbitrary imagination of my so-called life, or the foolish notion of alignment or disalignment with one so-called life purpose, all of which is adolescent spiritual materialism. To do anything with yourself or anything about yourself, obviously, at least to my way of thinking, as blasphemous as it may be, is the continuity of the imagination of that very self and the baggage of personal experience and personal memory and personal injury and wound. If we imagine there to be some omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent being, call it God or whatever, that is prior to ourselves, other than ourselves, imbued with creative powers that we, let's say, fail to have, from whom we can supplicate, personal benefit, or to whom we can attribute good luck or bad luck, well, we remain in the delusion that there is something prior to this present moment, and or that there was an author or building blocks that assembled the universe and the curious dissemination of consciousness, human or otherwise. So that's just another great turtle story. And of course, there's thousands of them, if not millions. Whatever one might be thinking of in present experience and ruminating over or considering, and then therefore self-defining, well, that's just another cosmology event. That's just another great turtle story. Perhaps present experience can be seen and felt, appreciated as an autonomous primacy, not as the consequence of anything or anyone doing anything at all. Consciousness is, you know, duplicitous by nature. Consciousness is also unicity by nature. The movement of mind or thought, the accusation and assignment of objects, subjects, temporality and spatiality, exaggerated with the profundity of memory, is alluring, profoundly and impersonally alluring. And then suggest the story of oneself, both the context and the content, and the so-called circumstances, and the reporting on prior experience, all of which is remarkably arbitrary, narcissistic, of course, and relies on our gullibility to believe that what the mind is capable of saying or thinking or projecting is at all true. If the myth and allure of the individual being that carries all the sorrow, all the regret, all the insult, the fear, the loathing, and the bracing, regardless of race, color, gender, socioeconomic class, or whether you're an esteemed Pleiadian or Arcturian, or just a blue-collar human waiting patiently for extinction. If one is bound or inspired to resolve the sentimental or emotional or circumstantial disappointments of life, then one, of course, remains a victim to the vagaries and perturbations of consciousness in all its grandeur and despair. what might it feel like if we were not compelled psychiatrically, psychologically, sentimentally to do anything with, to do anything about ourselves. If the compulsion to justify and validate went silent. You'd likely not be involved in trying to convince or cajole or seduce another human being or enroll them in a path of correction. Foment the illusion of false hope. Strategies and interventions. You wouldn't hold yourself out as being an authority on anything at all. There's an inner freedom from objectification and subjectification, an inner freedom from the myth and mirth of conscious contact. There's no reliance on knowledge, personal experience. No claim need be made about anything, can be made about anything. That's the kernel of abiding freedom. You don't pander to the myth of human misery, sell solutions to human misery, enroll vulnerable persons in cult ideation or institutionalized religions. Repetition of exotic chanting so that you can someday buy a pink Cadillac. One doesn't abuse the vulnerability and the frailty of human gullibility by selling remedies or even relief. The spiritual marketplace is so rife with the repetition and reinforcement of delusion and preys upon the vulnerability and the naivete of those that suffer. You can find in contemporary spiritual and New Age come-ons the mention of dimensions. Bentinho Massaro does it. Meher Baba did it. Matt Kahn does it. The ufologists, the ancient aliens, all of this elaborate New Age lizard skin conspiratorial nonsense, as entertaining as it may be, is just distraction. We become slaves to the so-called knowledge of others, the experience of others, the inner secrets and insights of others, their fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensional consciousness that speaks to them through their guides and gives them instructions on brand new ways to help humanity relieve itself from sorrow. And this snake oil, of course, has been going on since before Moses came down from the mountain with the stones. The nature of emptiness, nourishment, novelty, is exactly present, not other than here, other than now, over a Tibetan mountain pass, or through the lush jungles of a Peruvian shamanic enclave. To tangle with the content of mind is always so tiresome, including the four questions and the turnaround. Content is proliferative, it is imaginative, it is infinite in its permutation, it is inexhaustible. So any and all association with the movement of mind and narrative, whether afflicting or non-afflicting, is just another habit of self-reference, distraction. Because we feel not good, and we want to feel better than not good, and some celebrity, spiritual celebrity, comes along, with or without cockroach, or peacock, or hookah, and tries to explain to us what this is and why it is and how and what and where we've gone wrong, and therefore what we should do about ourselves to mitigate affliction. And this is all dysfunctional codependency and enabling behavior of the principal narcissistic myth, self-consumed nature of human identification. Fundamental malnourishment springs forth from the delusion of self and other, the disenfranchisement, the minimalization, the shunning and shaming of self and other, the authority of the God the authority of the parent, the politician, the peace worker. Whoever's carrying heat. The yoga of freedom is the dismantling of objectification, accusation, measure, memory. Though these feature sets of consciousness may, and why shouldn't they, continue to function in the way that they do. You could say the release is from the sense of inner authority, or the split that suggests an authoritative creator and the self-loathing sinful nature of oneself. Or that our freedom and dignity somehow were to be dependent on the way that we behave. We place the saint in unearned high regard, and we treat the incarcerated minions with violence. We are inept. We are inept to the task of liberation. And that's good news. Even the inspiration to apprehend, to acquire, to understand, to cultivate are time-bound. And depend on the interpretive function, the overlay, an interpretive function of mind or experience and qualification as we attempt to convince ourselves more or less non-stop about the nature of our present or past or future experience and everything we think we need to do and not do to feel this differently. as the matrix of fantasy collapses or erodes, and we see through the geometry and the means that fantasy is suggested, purchased, gift-wrapped, and re-gifted. We see intimately the nature of ideation, proliferation, and assignment. And that matrix of fantasy no longer becomes overwhelming, delusional. By seeing the nature of spontaneous and impersonal association clearly and clearly and clearly without qualification, then this sway that the reflex of assignment has on one's so-called self or mind, the sway and the swoon, is mitigated. There is obliterative simplicity in the midst of a complex and uncertain world. It's just us. Let me get a little water. Yeah, okay.
Object, it could be argued, is something that can be touched and held, seen and defined. So, if that's the case, that would include the past and the future. Because that is let's say you're bamboozled into having it into thinking that it's an actuality.
Yes.
Makes it an object. I mean.
Yes.
And that seems a little tricky, a little slippery.
You think? I mean, how come there's 7.3 billion and, let's say, on a good day, 4,000 awakened humans? I mean, I don't know how many awakened humans there are. You know, maybe there's 100,000. Maybe there's a million. Maybe of the 7.3 billion, there's 1 billion. It doesn't seem that way. So it's hard to, do a statistical comparison. But were there a statistical comparison could be drawn, you'd say the relatively few number of human beings resting in a different way than insanity is due to the very slippery nature of what objectification is.
Even knowledge.
It's a bad rap.
Can't hold on to anything.
You cannot hold on to anything.
No.
So that's the revelation. I mean, to see in present, in real time experience, because, you know, in the past,
that's all there is.
So in the past, you know, you're imagining, in the future, you're imagining. And most of us, of course, are likewise imagining in real time without noticing it, because we are under the sway and influence of the myth of oneself, the storyline of one's associations. When you see that that myth creation is on you in real time, in presently attuned or attentive experience, then you could say there's a certain kind of waking up that occurs. Because you cannot find, in a manner of speaking, and you cannot hold on to anything. Because the refresh rate of the present moment is ecstatic and certainly non-temporal, trans-temporal. I mean, what is the refresh rate of present experience? How long does it take the moment that's passing to become the moment that's new? And aren't those strangely concomitant? So what we call present experience is the, right, the marriage, if you will, of evaporation and refresh. And there is no delay. And it's always that. So you're like, and then the, you know, the capacity of mind to extract and then accuse and create the hysteria of self folds. You know, maybe not without a fight. And, you know, the fight could last a number of decades or lifetimes. This doesn't give up without a fight. Why should it? And do what it wants.
But the folding is, it's of the nature of the past. And it's either present or it's not.
Yeah, you could go with that, present or not.
Because you can't claim that it has folded.
Yep. It's too new. Yeah.
But then you're reaching backwards.
Yeah, you see that, you know, the nature of objectification or objectifying or storytelling and narrative can only occur by refusing or ignoring the actual demonstration of experience. So we ignore what's actually so, improvisationally unscripted, and pluck from it arbitrarily impressions that appear to line up and foment or construct the myth of oneself, the myth of personal duration. Now we have, you know, every superstition and every belief and every justification to territorialize and or violate others that might be encroaching upon, right, our territorial interests.
Something about, like, some kind of confusion about the idea of others. So, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Well, others is you know, a word that suggests all that can be found is what's appearing in and as your present experience. So let's say you're looking at what you think to be me, or listening to whom or what you think to be me. But if I exist, I'm only existing, right, as an impression field of your experience.
And I would say that when one speaks in a manner that is here and now.
Yeah.
There is a different quality to that that makes you not an other.
Yes, that's right.
You're not other.
That's right. If you're, and as one gets a little better or more acquainted with, you know, grooving on or as present experience, then the choice of words and the rhythm of words spoken and the implication of those words ideally, you know, reinforce the intimacy of presence itself, not the imposition of explanation or instruction or shame, blame, or should. Just, here. Yes.
Do not feel capable.
Well, you.
You
might be much better at it than you think. You know, you haven't, you know, perhaps taken the risk to practice it as much as I have taken the risk to practice it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like trying to nail something down which you cannot nail down. Describe something which you cannot describe. And yet, I guess if you're familiar enough, you can walk that line. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's one's primary relationship with whatever life might be? It's like, there's like, I mean, undefended naivete, undefended incredulity, undefended wonder. Here this is. Whoa. And the tendency of mind to objectify and qualify and compartmentalize and come up with story of deceit or disappointment or who did what and what did who and what needs to happen so I can improve my vipassana practice so I can get enlightened someday. That nonsense is just shut down.
Bob, if I were to say what you just said.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would be holding on to it. Like, I don't think you are. But that doesn't even make sense. However, for me, it would be like, I know something, and that it would have a different quality.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like,
it can.
If I would be claiming to know that this happened or has happened, It can actually be a constricting.
Yes.
See.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I might go into this small place to come out with that.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So, you know, let's say just for fun, if one were playing around with speaking in an unscripted manner on this curious topic. Well, you know, it's, you have to screw up a lot.
And of course.
Yeah.
And you can sense it. Perfectly fine.
That's right. That's the fun of it.
Yeah.
I mean, why not fuck up?
Yeah.
You know, and feel yourself feeling yourself and feel yourself, let's say, feeling an other or others in the conversation. And then feeling yourself to see how things are landing in you as you speak and hear them, and or in others as you perceive how they may be responding to what it is that you're saying. So there's a certain quality or buoyancy that you can, one learns to trust and ride, if you will, or surf. And then the, you know, the communion or the communication is arising, as does all communication, you know, from the elasticity of that buoyancy, rather than from the congestion, right, of belief or superstition or sales.
So let's say that there's a signature to those two occurrences. Riding.
Yes, there is a signature.
Has a certain outside I like continuity, a certain expansiveness.
Sure, yeah.
Where the other, and could say exactly the same thing.
It could be.
Has a but it's constriction. You know, it's not expansive, it's constriction.
Yeah.
And it's a claim. It's a little thing.
Yes. Yeah, you can feel the difference between claiming and not claiming.
Yeah. So, in my opinion,
it's
not good, but I'm more comfortable with silence. My mouth being quiet.
Sure.
Because that seems to get me into a more to communicate for me. Seems to be shut me down. But, you know, perhaps, as you say, something you gotta play with.
No, why not? You know, like.
Yeah, you're right, absolutely.
I mean, you know, a musician writes a song. Sometimes the phrasing and the lyrics just come magically in a very, you know, kind of gift of improvisational channeling, if you will. And, whoa. I mean, and, you know, many of them are, right, incredibly healing, beautiful, right, songs. Some of them are commercial crap, but, you know, you give it your best shot. You know, how many pieces of paper are thrown away for the moment where, you know, the gift speaks? So I think it's similar in experimenting with speaking about an impossible topic, which is really it's a shamanic event of, you know, eliciting self-attention. Some speakers want attention from you. Because if there's content and claim, then that content and that claim, in a sense, demands your attention so that you can receive and agree with and file away and make use of what it is that's being presented. And that's just tension. If there's no claim, there's no cosmology and no superstition, well, that's open. And so then the communion is more shared, in a sense, shared. Some people could refute that, and I wouldn't defend it. You know, shared attention is simply be attentive to your own experience, not to me personally or what I'm saying, it really doesn't have quite any value or merit of its own accord.
Well, my experience is that I can recognize the signature is already come up with. The signature of let's say undefended. And that's attractive.
Yes.
Whereas the signature of the person who has a point to make is different.
Yes.
And so there's a... That's like being attracted to yourself, to what actually is.
Yes. Here this is. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get any simpler than that. You don't have to get all Zhou Chen about it. You know, here this is. Oh, boy.
And it's just... I feel like, I mean, for words which, you know, are not good, but I feel like, oh boy, here this is, oh boy,
yeah.
Is that here this is what actually is.
Okay.
Sure. And all the rest, you know, so it's very different.
Oh, sure.
In that way.
Well, it's liberating.
Mm-hmm.
One doesn't resolve the disappointments of one's life. One is simply no longer bound or defined by memory, its content or its context. And the, you know, the willingness to take, you know, a certain kind of leap a leap of faith or a leap of magic to discover that present experience is not and need not be bound by inertia. Recollection, memory, accusation, knowledge, assignment, strategy, time, preference,
right and wrong,
ethicality, morality, morals, right and wrong, valuable or not valuable. The matrix of value assignment of its own accord collapses, abates, explodes, is seen through. And with the abatement of value propositions, the assignment of value propositions, so too is the collapse of psychological time. And the, you know, the hubris and pride of the individuated self. Because all that stuff is manufactured through narrative. The sensing is still present. Sensing is still present. I mean, maybe one can go into a nirvikalpic, rigor mortis, samadhi of no longer possessing recording consciousness. You know, it's ecstatic trance state. And that's cool, but it's not really necessary to be overly dramatic. The cessation of assignment and implication is simply present. You know, the ecstasy is like a, you know, hold the whipped cream. You know, to be imagining that oneself need be dependent on euphoria, bliss, ecstasy, etc., etc., it's a drag. You know, and this worshipping that we do of mutant celebrities, whether in the spiritual arts or the performing arts or politics or sports or wealthy persons or, you know, God knows what, you know, that's just kind of a disappointment. What do they say? Giving one's power away? Yeah. If you don't look and shake your hands like you're Sagadatta, well then, you know, you ain't got nothing. If you don't have at least a diaper and a peacock, you know, and a shocky pot feather in your closet, well, you ain't nothing. Right? If you can't recite, you know, the Vedas or the Puranas or the, you know, Tao or the this, you ain't got nothing. But all of that shit is just ornamentation. The dependency on, you know, mutant human behavior, specialized to be a sign of, you know, something useful, good, and true. Human mistake, walking on water, gesticulating madly, going into rigor mortis, samadhis, trance states. Who the fuck cares?
I would think that it's. The outward behavior is irrelevant, but, and they know it, but those around them don't understand that.
You know, that's what this does. This is just, you know, this is the three-ring circus. You can see that it proliferates, you know, from nowhere, from nothing, into a profound drama field, right, of impression. It's self-deluding, but it's also self-liberating. And it, you know, it's no more self-liberating than it is self-deluding. You could say in the hands of what we call human beings, you know, by the numbers, it appears to be more successfully self-deluding than it is self-liberating. Okay. Well, it's a young species. You know, soon to be no more.
Soon to be improved upon.
Soon to be improved upon. Yeah. Right. It's a bad idea that a species that's this spiritually immature and so contentious by nature learns how to, you know, drill for oil or split an atom. It's like, oh man, that's a bad balance factor. Because once, you know, a consciousness like ours, a contentious, right, violent, self-deluding consciousness like ours is imbued with, you know, technological prowess, boy, it's like someone just slammed the pedal all the way to the floor. It doesn't take long from there. You know, politicalism can't work, and economicism can't work, those are not the means by which a, let's say, telepathic species functions. A telepathic species that has matured deeply into transtemporal communion does not use the kinds of societal structures that we use to organize life. I mean, the structures that we use at this level of maturity to organize life, well, are exploited to a man, to a woman. Every system is exploited. It's just boundary condition after boundary condition, territory after territory, ceremonially and otherwise. So, you know, just as you could say the roll of the dice, you come up with nitrogen-fixing bacteria so that you could create fertilizers. Right, and fertilizers and irrigation systems and technology permits the proliferation of agriculture rather than right hunting, gathering, and foraging. So now you've institutionalized agriculture, and of course, you know, the steam engine or the ox cart and the burning of fossil fuels, etc., etc., and then of course, you know, wired electricity coming from coal burning, oil burning, nukes, some amount of water, wind, and sun, and the proliferation of the storage of that agriculture in, you know, through refrigeration. And then the, you know, systematic abuse of animal husbandry and over-reliance on animal flesh. And you add all of these, you know, incredible gifts together, and you've got a runaway heat engine that cannot survive at that depth of density with those technologies under this atmosphere for very long. So if you look at the scale of the burst of technological advancement occurring in really the shortest blip of a moment from a vantage point of, you know, human time or, right, geological time. It's like, whoosh. I mean, we're like a match, right? Even though we had our history and our prehistory and, right, ancient, let's say, Earth or solar or even galactic history, cosmos history, the appearance of the human being, right, on the terrestrial mantle is like, whoosh, it's like flash paper. And perhaps we are, you know, if you want to be get into extinction poetry, perhaps we are, you know, alive in the generation that may witness the die-off. From, you know, whether it's a nuclear accident or the ravages of rapidly deteriorating climate influences and the ability to grow food or peak oil or what have you, just political contention.
Well, that would certainly test the quality of being here and now.
It does. It does a lot. I think, you know.
But.
Yeah.
Test away.
Test away. That's right. You know, in any of these ancient and forgivable cosmologies, you know, whether Eastern or Western or African, South American, what have you. Yeah, there's, I think you can find, you know, if you're a comparative religion PhD or a comparative shamanic culture PhD, you can always find tremendous emphasis placed on impermanence. Whether it's going to the burning ghat and meditating on, you know, bones, or the various kinds of meditations on death that you find in, you know, Buddhist culture, etc., all over the place. So that a meditation on impermanence is always an essential ingredient of, you know, liberating technology, no matter where you look. And it just might be that in the current milieu, current generation, now it really means something. Yeah. You know, I think too much enlightenment teaching is so trivial, so pedestrian. You know, we suffer so much in the ways that we suffer so much in the various abuses and shame and things that we, you know, obviously suffer from, loss and grief and rage and violence. And so, you know, we look to the myth of enlightenment or other, you know, acquisitions as medicine, as being ameliorative, healing, releasing of the momentum and the sorrow of suffering. And we get taken in by, you know, attractive persons giving attractive teachings in exchange for fealty, loyalty, cash, testimonials. And
I would say that those people are getting what they want, which is something.
That's right.
And unfortunately, something is not has no actual value.
Yeah.
So
it's my I subscribe to that too.
I mean, they're looking for some sort of a power to make it different. That has an action on objects.
Yes, that is the realm of the magician. Right? The human as magician wants to have agency, influence, power over objects to, right, influence how things are experienced or felt, whether it's through the acquisition of money, security, celebrity, not suffering, power, whatever. Yeah, so that is the realm of the magician. That's the realm in which human beings strive and struggle and fail.
And yes, it can't actually work. But,
no.
But it seems as though you got to climb a ways before you realize that you're not getting anywhere.
Yes, it does.
People don't seem to realize early on. They continue for a while, and then they're like, oh, nothing's happened.
Yeah, I think it's a fair observation to make of, you know, religious and spiritual culture that a certain exhaustion, you know, needs to be reached or approached to see through the momentum of self, the agony of, you know, being self-consumed as a way of life. And willing to go through, let's say, you know, the fear and the disorientation of challenging the reflex to be self-consumed. Yeah. You know, will whatever this is, God or whatever it is, doesn't have to be anthropomorphized, but will whatever this is take good care of me? My money, my car, my job, my kids, my reputation, my hair, my health, my friends.
Think not.
There's plenty of evidence, you know, so-called on Earth to see, no, it's not taking good care of a lot of people.
But to me, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's again, it's small. It's too small.
Yeah, you see, we are
it's too small.
We are products, or to be more outlandish about it, we are victims of our own imagination and our capacity to commune and appreciate with, the effulgence of life is limited to, looking not too far beyond our own nose. Yeah. We're localized. The localization of self and body and mind.
Usually, the concept of time does the same thing.
Yes.
It's a severe limitation.
Yes. You can see the severity, the comprehensiveness of limitation that is an imposition through the conceiving mind. And yet we turn to that mind as the authority, as the arbiter, as the guru and God and news reporter to tell us what's happening, what's so, what's true. So we remain unconsciously, hypnotically abiding in smallness. And, bracing in fear, right? Apprehension, anger, rage, xenophobia, misogyny, misanthropy, anger, violation. Because of the contraction of identification. The mistrust, you could say, of whatever the natural world is, to be on our side.
And both a devotion to hope, I suppose. There's this idea that there's something that can be held on to.
Yes.
Again, with the magician, they can bring a change to some object.
It's all in the realm of the magician, right? The supplication, bargaining, threatening, so that whatever this is or isn't provides whatever it is we think we need and or deserve or are entitled to for our so-called personal survivability or, the survivability of those we feel loyal to, whether it's our local family, extended family, or, members of our belief group.
There is a certain responsibility that, that I feel, which I guess I honor that.
Yeah.
Even though I could say I don't feel that I am obligated to.
Right.
But it seems to be seems appropriate. I don't know.
Whatever. whatever passing sentiment might walk through that looks like care, compassion, responsibility, accountability, empathy. It's like, far out. it's not necessarily defining.
It might go back to be rooted in the not doing. Because if those are the things that are that you're entangled with.
Yes.
It's not necessarily. It can be just an action that arises in like a logical.
Whatever this is doing, it's doing, and that includes everything we think we're doing and not doing, including the myth of self-will or the absence of self-will?
Well, this might be not sounding this as a good thing. Just reporting that.
Yeah.
Actions can have a signature too.
Sure.
A signature of ease.
Yes.
Or exhausting failure even.
Absolutely. You know, so. You may as well throw in a pinch of agony. And defeat.
I have a definite tendency to have a belief that which is useful is, let's say, karma, is proper karma.
Yes, well, yeah. I got in trouble today, as I often do. You know, one of these meetups that I follow, perhaps voyeuristically, to my own demise or detriment, you know, they came up with another one of these New Age spiritual programs where the opening salvo was, if you're in alignment with your life's purpose, then things are going to be easeful, right? And if you're not in alignment with your life's purpose, as if you could possibly have anything at all to do with that, well, then your life is going to be filled with, right, the regret and dissatisfactions that so many people suffer from. And so, obviously, to me, it's a blasphemous and blatant oversimplification. It's absolutely untrue. It's New Age pablum, and it's shaming. Because if you read it, and you're like, well, gee, my life sucks maybe a lot of the time for all the reasons that it does, so I must not be, according to these two fuckers, these two authorities holding a healing workshop for my benefit, I must not be in alignment. There must be fear and pain and this and that, or all kinds of things that I'm harboring, consciously or otherwise, that are making me out of alignment with whatever my life's mission and purpose is, as if there were a life's mission or a purpose, or that anyone could actually be in possession of a mission or a purpose. And so I have to go to this workshop to figure out why am I such a fuck up, and then feeling the way that I'm feeling. And these two or ten or a million or whoever the guru is are going to give me, you know, tools and ecstatic experiences so that I can move from whatever despair I'm having to whatever ease of being I crave. The whole thing is shaming. Because I'm not a naive, an innocent, a vulnerable human being suffering in the way that we suffer reads this message and internalizes, once again, what's wrong with me? Because these so-called New Age or spiritual authorities told me that the reason I'm having the difficulties I'm having is because I'm out of alignment with my life's mission and purpose. And if I hang out with them, the odds are good that I will discover what my life's mission and purpose will be. And at the end of Sunday, I will suffer no longer. I mean, oh my God.
I think that parrot is effective because it can be experienced that way sometimes. So there is a bit of truth in it.
I have to admit, yes. Well, sure, you can characterize a life of suffering or a life of less suffering or a life of no suffering any way you want to, but it's still the imagination, right? The narcissistic in self-enfolded imagination of what one takes their life to be, and then looks to circumstances and events as the arbiters of whether I'm doing well or not doing well, and then creates the myth of authority or someone who's pretending to live according to their life's purpose and therefore have a lot to teach me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just horrible.
So if I get what you're saying, that's a huge...
It's all shame-based. It's all shame-based. And yet, if I call someone on it, which I did, because I wrote You know, I read this thing and I'm like, ouch, it's horrible that you would do that.
Yeah.
Once again, solicit, seduce, dismiss, and minimize someone's, you know, life vitality by reducing the richness of their mystery to being either in or out of alignment, and then being there as some kind of spiritual and accomplished authority to provide them with a path to a better life. It's horrible. It's heartbreaking. But we're so gullible and so vulnerable in our codependency, in the murky myth of individuation and self-loathing, that we'll sign up for anything and do. I mean, you know, not a week goes by with a new cult and a new celebrity and a new, right, situation of abuse, right, is exposed. Shambhala, right? Bentinho Massaro, Mas Sahade,
so
whatever his name is. Mata Amritananda Mayima.
No, not him.
Her.
Okay.
Hugging everyone, you know, for the cost of a high-priced coconut. Or, you know, doll.
No.
Yeah.
So my mind is, you know, take it like you say, and coming up with... The wrong turn is at a different point. It's at the point of the individual once again attempting to manipulate objects for a certain outcome.
Yes, but before that you
would
say
you want to be before that.
Yeah, you have to, because if you're already in the response, if you're in they call it the zone of response or the zone of reply, you're already symptomatic of a, you know, a profound misunderstanding that you haven't yet cracked the code on.
Yeah, so that, and they offer absolutely no help at that point.
No.
None. They're just going to keep them.
That's right.
Down the road where they're in track.
Byron Katie does not create autonomous students.
Yeah.
She creates annuities. It's true that, you know, of course, in a field of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that have spent, you know, money or used her work, generous offering of her work freely, of course you're going to find a couple of mutant celebrities that show up and go, what the fuck, and wake up. And in their waking up, whatever it is, they either continue to be, you know, spokesmodels for her, you know, solution set, or they break away from her and use some combination of their own insight, instinct, and the work, or, you know, Scott Killeby's living dialogues and all that poor shit, to be a helpmate, usually paid, spiritual therapist, spiritual life coach, paid, right, healer, provider of relief or release to somebody else. So it's a pyramid scheme.
It's the thing that is already a result of the self, the individuation, right? What they're offering to help them with is
the resolution of a phantom.
Yeah.
The polishing of a ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and which understandably, naturally, if by design or otherwise, simply reinforces.
Totally, or dissonant.
Yes.
Completely.
And yet you can't say with any confidence that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people or perhaps millions of people are helped by Ram Dass, by Byron Katie, by Scott Killeby, by Peter Brown, by Paul Hederman, you know, by the Dalai Lama, by Mata Amritananda Mayima, by Karuna Mayi, by every, you know, line them up, Jeff Foster, you know, on and on at nauseam.
I don't remember his name, but he mentioned Jeff Foster. I like that guy.
Sure. What's not to like?
But it was... but it was speaking, it was saying what I'm going to say I know to be true.
Which, uh-huh.
You know, you take that any way you want. But that's what's attractive. Not.
What's attractive is more about me.
And the me, but the me, the me can be something you recognize as, well, let's say nourishing. So that's what's attractive.
Yeah. You know,
but it doesn't have, there's no agenda in it.
That would be nice.
What I find attractive doesn't have an agenda. It's like sitting down with anybody that you know well enough to communicate.
Yes.
Like maybe you don't even have to speak.
Sure.
Just be in the same room. Sort of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's just a certain freedom, you can say anything. Because there's a freedom of, safety, I guess.
Well, whatever the geometry or structure of localization is, whether that's objectification, subjectification, identification with body, mind, memory, past, sensation, you know, morality, ethicality, who knows?
I would call it mirroring. That is
mirroring is fine. You can boil it all down to mirroring.
Yeah.
So if there's localization, you know, then there's the I, me, mine, you know, the duration of myself, my life, my memory, my stuff, my relations, my ideas, my sentiments. That's the realm of the magician. What would it look like or feel like, just for fun, you know, to see through the
if it's satisfying
compulsion?
I'm not sure that I would want to see through it.
That's correct. Most people do not want to tangle with this.
If I'm happy there, I'm happy.
Well, if you're happy or you're miserable. I mean, just as many miserable people refuse liberation as do happy people.
I suppose.
Or the ones in between that aren't quite sure whether they're happy or miserable.
Well, some people may enjoy being miserable.
I would imagine, yes.
Because it gives them a... It gives them a great story.
Maybe. You know, we can say, why are you happy being happy?
Uh-huh.
Or why are you happy being miserable? Uh-huh. Why are you miserable being miserable? Or why are you miserable being happy?
Yeah, right.
And anyone can tell you anything they want. And they will.
Yeah.
Does that make it true? I'm not so sure.
Well, the trick is, because also, in the end... It's all included, every single possibility.
Yeah.
It's included in the the singularity.
Yeah, if it's included and this is inclusive and if it's one or if it's two or if it's none, yeah, it's all included.
And that becomes, I think that seems to be even beyond thought.
Absolutely.
So a thought can't, like...
Present experience is not occurring at the pleasure of thought. Thought has nothing to do with the irrefutability and the nature of present experience in the way that it's felt. In the way that it is insistent, completely without any choice on your part. I'm sorry, what choice do you have? What agency do you have? How much influence do you think you have over you know, the cascading nature of euphoric experience? How about none? How about none at all? And yet the miraculous capacity to use language and symbols as points of reference to construct content and context makes it look like you're loaded with agency, power, will, choice, decision.
Why do we continually do that? Well, what do we say we are not continually doing
that's
that?
Right, that's
it
right.
It is simply happening.
You could go with the Naho thing.
But then, I mean, if you extract thought from whatever is occurring,
okay,
then there is no question.
Yes.
And it is all accepted.
Okay.
And...
But what if it's so, let's say, beyond, which is still right here and right now, but in this perfectly strange right here and right now, whatever those might imply, there just is no reference to human construct. Not of space, not of time, not of purpose, not of mission, not of alignment, not of unalignment.
Certainly.
Yes.
Certainly. Which then makes it, then the idea of the suffering, there's no amelioration for suffering.
No.
Nor is there the desire to ameliorate suffering.
That's right.
So just all those things need not apply.
Yeah, rather than turn the other cheek, it's more like just take it on the chin. Do we think that security or validation, existential validation, is dependent on human acceptance, right? Human acknowledgement, which are, you know, more emotional, you could say sentimental, but still deep needs of successful primate, you know, maturation, to walk confidently and autonomously into whatever life is and be, you know, an actor, a player. So, we can see that, you know, behavioral advantages or behavioral disadvantages through child rearing, through education, through wealth or not wealth, may or may not have any bearing on the degree to which one, you know, suffers or doesn't suffer. Acts, you know, profoundly or regrettably.
But you started that out with evaluation, feeling valued?
Yeah.
So, I think... I'm trying to come up with a word that describes what I was referring to as having a signature, a certain signature.
Yes.
So I don't know what I would describe it as.
Well, you know, I read something Muji wrote. I'm not a big fan of his, quite the opposite, but, you know, he's not a fool. So he was pointing to, in this little snippet, you know, what is it that knows that you know? Or what is it that knows that you don't know? Right? So once again, he was, you know, wisely, as any guru in orange clothing would do, draw attention back to what's behind, right, the presumptuous myth of oneself. Mm-hmm. Pointing once again to, right, That which does the knowing of which is known, or that which is known, or the knowing of that which is not known. Of the knowing of the presence of a suffering self, or the knowing of the relief of the absence of
right.
a suffering self.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's
that seems to be appropriate.
Yeah, so it's always strangely paradoxical, is that
but it's attractive to come to the place recognizing the noon, I guess. Use that comparison.
Yeah, could be.
Recognizing the... I favor the word truth. That's my favorite.
Why not?
But recognizing that which actually is, that's what it is.
Okay.
Because so much is not.
Well, of course. I mean, everything is and isn't.
Right.
I mean, if it's all inclusive and everything is and isn't, at the same time. So you can't posit what is as contrasted with what isn't, or actual or non-actual.
The one thing that is not impermanent. It's recognizing the one thing that is not impermanent, as opposed to
yes, of course, but then there's the subtle objectification of that which is, right, not impermanent. It's like, what? Because...
But that doesn't necessarily... I don't think that necessarily has to be the case.
No, not necessarily, of course.
Because
but here we are.
It can't be spoken.
Yes.
And,
but we'll call it something anyway.
And we'll say that it is at a point where there is no thought. Let's just say there's no thinking going on.
Okay.
And then we recognize that.
Yeah, check.
So,
all right.
Then if that's the knowing that whatever you said.
You see, so the difficulty is, you know, in language, in communication, mm-hmm. right, spiritually, religiously, or otherwise. Symbol systems like language are referential, and thereby, in the use of symbology, language, accusation, objectification, even calling something a double negative, a triple negative, a quadruple negative, that which is behind, that which is behind, that which is behind, that behind. You know, there's no end to how many iterations of emptiness or how many iterations of beyond or behind you can get to. That's why, you know, a lot of spiritual racketeers use, well, I'm going to communicate with you through the fifth dimension. And I'm going to call it mindfulness from the fifth dimension. And you're like, so what do you mean? Like, John Kabat-Zinn was two-dimensional mindfulness, but Matt Kahn is fifth-dimensional mindfulness, and Bentinho Massaro is seventh-dimensional mindfulness? Well, go for the seventh-dimensional. You know, get your money's worth. But what the fuck? I mean, next week, someone named, you know, Amoda Mai Janaki, right, Blissanand, calls it eighth dimensional. And you're like, well, let's move over here now. Yeah, so you see the proliferative nature of whatever this is or isn't is, as you pointed out, slippery.
That's what I heard with some comedian talking about the new iPhone. And he's like, well, if it was any good, it would be the last iPhone.
Yeah, if it was any good, it would be the last iPhone. You know? That's right.
But it's new. It's new. It's 8. It's 9.
Yeah.
And it just goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, the fundamental nature of codependency. Codependency is systemic to individuation. They're the same. You know, the myth of individuation, separate of being, is codependent, is vulnerable, is naive, is subject to manipulation, hypnotic suggestion, and, you know, impression management. Okay, I mean...
It's limited.
Yeah, I mean that's
by virtue of the limitation.
That's
vulnerability.
Yes, that's how one so-called person exploits themselves or exploits another. It's through this, you know, mishmash, right? Compendium of vulnerability, codependency, addiction, right? Shame. And then, you know, since you're feeling really shitty, which is easy to do, someone comes along and says they're going to give you mindfulness from the fifth dimension. or from the Arcturians or the Pleiadians or whatever, you know.
As long as it's different, you can pretend and think that it could make a difference.
Yes. Well, this is the greed of the continuity of self. I'm not ready to be done with the myth of myself, with the tension and performance anxiety of becoming. I'm not done with, existential despair, because I don't understand what it really is. So I take the image of myself to be a binding, and I suffer. So I will sign up for anyone and anything to give me new news about myself or otherwise, so that I can pretend to take steps to suffer less and come more into alignment with my life's mission and my life's purpose. Horrible. It's the perpetuation of suffering. And yet, when I wrote that thing on that so-called meetup page, as I was setting the computer up, I got a reply from one of the organizers and, took me to task.
Yeah.
Right? Because I leaned into their spiritual offering, did something completely out of the ordinary, and said, this is shaming language, and it's not true. When their whole validation is based on it being true for some people and justifying their spiritual offering.
And believing that they
yes.
are, because I have no idea, but it's soothing to them to quote unquote help others. So,
yeah.
So you're
the codependency.
Attacking them right where their hope is.
Well, attacking maybe, pointing out maybe.
Well, I don't mean you personally were attacking, but
right.
by
yes.
Undermining a belief.
I have been thrown out of meetings and off of meetup pages for taking the, risk to call bullshit on this kind of, New Age narrative.
Yeah.
This condemning New Age narrative.
I don't understand that. I get it.
Yeah.
Because if you take that away, then what have they got?
What have they got? That's right. If you're a healer, if a mystic or a channeler or a medium or a yoga teacher, or a New Age business person, then you have to come up with gimmickry and seduction and hypnosis and codependent offerings in exchange for cash to justify, your presumed existence as a healer, as an intervener, as someone that is practicing so-called compassion in their lives.
Someone who is valuable in the lives of others.
Absolutely valuable.
No.
Yeah. And in my little gesture, because it doesn't take much, it really doesn't take much at all, to puncture a hole in a big balloon.
Uh-huh.
So you put a little hole in the balloon and you see, what kind of retaliatory rhetoric you get back to defend this codependency, to defend the, tragedy of codependency and abuse. Exploitation. But okay.
Yeah.
It's not the first time I haven't. Not the first time I've done it. Probably not the last. So if there's a so, how difficult must it be? Yeah. I'm not dismissing suffering or holding anyone accountable or responsible for why and how suffering occurs. On the cross, right? Everyone's on the cross. Experience is on the cross, right? The great tragedy and masquerade and majesty of present experience is on the cross, ongoingly. It's a catharsis. Ongoingly, it's a catharsis. How you live with that catharsis, how you speak with people, right, through that catharsis, how you become of service, is depends on your skill set, your maturity, you know, what you've learned, what you've been able to discover.
Do you feel like wanting to help is natural outcome? Because I don't have that desire.
Jeffrey Dahmer wanted to help, you know. So he cut his victims up into pieces and put them in the refrigerator so that they would never leave his side.
Yeah.
You know, that was a way of wanting to help.
I think that however it is, unless someone comes to me.
You know, whatever life is for you and or someone that may approach you or come into your company, that's just serendipity. You know, I mean, I felt just strongly compulsively compelled to experiment with having this conversation, expecting that it wouldn't take long for me to see that no one was interested, nor would they show up, and I could, you know, get over my messianic needs. But, you know, that it wasn't meant to happen. So, you know, a few people from time to time show up to, you know, do this. Mm-hmm. And that is the gift of meditation. That is the gift of mindfulness. That you can come together in an informal salon, egalitarian, non-authoritative salon, and kick it around.
Yeah.
So it's not
and
so
it's
much.
Extremely, for my opinion again, it's so slippery.
Yes.
It's so slippery that it's very helpful.
Yeah.
To have someone who sort of knows how to handle it.
I always found it valuable in my, you know, decades-long seeking career to find someone from time to time that could challenge and arouse and disrupt and piss me off, mm-hmm. you know, or offer some ongoing context for me to, you know, work out my shame, my illnesses, my codependence, my addiction, and my, you know, ongoing, you know, kind of call it devotion, you know, curiosity and devotion.
It seems to get stuck to what should you call it? I'll say a recipe or something, and think you're going to go somewhere. So it's very helpful when someone outside can say, you know.
It's very easy to fool ourselves on the meditation cushion. Even, you know, a week of meditation, a month, 3 years, 10 years, you know, these lengthy, isolating retreats through various, you know, means that people engage in. It is really easy for consciousness to fool itself over the long haul. Even in the presence of, you know, call it disruptive, psychic, perceptual changes, revelations, ecstasies, insights, all kinds of, you know, things. Demons, exhaustion, fatigue, you know, three nights awake, whatever, ayahuasca, da 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 da. It's very easy, as you can see, how this easily fools itself from moment to moment in the most, you know, innocent way. And so the movement and momentum of self and continuity and reference and mind persists even in the midst of subtle or, you know, cathartic spiritual experience.
Yes.
It doesn't take much.
It
doesn't take
much.
It's so...
It
always is.
And the next thing you know, we're making a planet.
That's right. That's right.
We got a whole private government.
Yeah. The power of, you know, what we call imagination or world organizing, right, capacity is profound. You are not going to outsmart it. You're not going to out-mindfulness it. You're not going to cultivate, you know, a high degree of ethicality, morality, or, you know, tick-not-punish interbeing and put a dent in it. You're just not. It's like, what's that material, you know, you're aware that a bullet can't penetrate?
Kevlar.
Fucking consciousness is Kevlar.
Yeah.
You can load it up with bullets, and it's like, har, de har, har, ho, ho, and fuck you. You can't take it down.
So when you use consciousness in that way, that is... You would think, and people are looking to be in touch with consciousness, but then when you use it in that way,
yeah,
it becomes it itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the Kevlar.
Yes. Consciousness is from one perspective.
You think that's what you're looking for.
Yes, from one perspective, let's say an earlier perspective when you're just on ramping.
Yeah.
You know, consciousness sounds like, oh, that's my destination.
Right.
Higher consciousness.
Right.
Right? Liberated consciousness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, after a few miles down the highway and a few, you know, cadavers and accidents along the way, right? Burned out automobiles, pileups. You know, you start to see, oh, consciousness? Fuck consciousness.
Yeah.
Because what we're referring to as consciousness in that manner is the, right, the existential pressure, the existential demonstration of felt experience. And if one is, you know, still relying upon the profound and evocative nature of felt experience, then you're still in codependency.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's kind of like, you know, what are you ready to give up? Well, when you first pick up your first, you know, meditation book or whatever, you know, you're ready to pick up this much and ready to let go of this much. You know, you're kind of, right? You're working it. And as you make a little more progress and discover just what a fraud and a liar you are, mm-hmm. I am, one is, then you might be willing to pick up a little something different or get rid of a little something more. So in that respect, you can use a kind of a gradual metaphor. As you on-ramp to dissolution,
yeah,
to just pierce the insistent and possible to kill perturbation of felt experience. So you don't negotiate with it. You see through it. But that's, again, that's the knowledge that knows that you see or don't see. It's not, right? It's not personalized any longer. It's not, oh, I know this or that. You know what about what? You know, to make a claim about my enlightenment or where I dwell or the manner in which I relate, it's like, yeah, what else you got? You know, really, shut the fuck up. But so many claims are made so that I can establish mastery, authority, the answer man, the go-to, who knows, you know, in many cases, not mine, thankfully, in many cases, you know, the transmission of powerful waves of Shakti and, you know, seductive inebriation. So people are like feeling ecstatic in your presence, you know, and praising the Lord. You're like, yeah, no. It's like, chill the fuck out. You know, by nature, you could say, let's say,
yeah,
I have.
So you stop seeking, and even because that, what you're describing, would be, let's say, inexplicable.
Sure.
So then, from one point of view, you would assume that the inexplicable is where you want to go.
Yes.
But when you get to the inexplicable,
you're going
to
turn and run.
It's like,
yes. Yeah.
More of the same.
Well, you can see how tenacious, right, the habit of orientation and the habit of, call it, selfing or self is. Let's say that whatever this is starts, you know, peppering you with freebies or gifts or moments of discontinuity, moments of, not call it, doesn't have to be disorientation, but non-orientation. Right, so you're being peppered with some gifts, whether in meditation, standing in line at the bank, falling asleep, waking up, getting into a fight, you know, a little road rage when someone cuts you off, whatever. And, you know, naturally your system, your organism wants to feed on that, wants more of that. Because, let's just say, discontinuity or dissolution or rapturous emptiness has a certain signature, and you're like, you'd be an idiot, right, not to want to return to the scene of the crime and get another taste of that shit. Why does someone go back, you know, let's say year after year, you know, to be poetic about it, lifetime after lifetime, to the same master each year, it to be in communion with that euphoria?
And there's nothing you can, there's nothing to take with you.
No. Sure, well, if there were something like freedom or truth, and who knows if there is or isn't, but if there were, yeah, you wouldn't be able to take it with you, you know?
Right.
You can't take it to go. Seeing whatever that implies, which is not obviously, you know, from the eyes, but from the entirety, right? Conscious contact is a plenum of, call it, seeing, of vibration, of throbbing. So the seeing is with the entire plenum, the non-specific plenum of experience itself. Experience sees itself,
mm-hmm.
not through the eyes,
mm-hmm.
not through the mind. It's just...
Mm-hmm.
Done. And there's no, let's hope, imagine that is, at least for a moment or two, if not for a while, the cessation of codependence. The cessation of enrolling naive and suffering persons into the myth of being aligned or not aligned. Because all of that is in the realm of the magician. It's just the perpetuation of sorrow.
I'm going to go use the bathroom.
Sure. I'm glad you guys are having fun out there. What's that, darling?
I'm gonna listen to this one.
You're gonna listen to what one?
What you guys talk about, I'll talk later.
Oh, okay. No problem. All right, it's 9:30. We beat this to death. Hey, thanks everyone for joining us. Nice to see you all. Glad you were there in the chat room having a lot of fun. Appreciate that. We'll see you at the next one.